This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 98, and I'm your host, Simon Bowen. My mission here at Alien UFO Podcast is to investigate all things that are part of the wider UFO phenomena. I'm looking at UFO sightings, alien abduction, historic cases and other related events. And I'm starting out something new, where every Thursday I will be releasing episodes called UFO Encounters, so please check them out. And if you want to hear the extended version of this interview, which is an extra 22 minutes, you'll need to join the Patreon campaign, where there are now more than 90 episodes in the back catalogue. For $5 a month, you get an extended episode every week, and for $2 a month, you get an extended episode every month. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe. This week, I'm talking to Carl Svozil about his book, UFOs, Unidentified Aerial Phenomena, Observations, Explanations, and Speculations. Carl is an Austrian physicist educated at the University of Vienna and at Heidelberg University. He was visiting scholar at the Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory of the University of California at Berkeley, the Lebedev Institute at the Moscow State University, and the Alfie Institute in St. Petersburg. He has done research in quantum theory, applications of computability theory, algorithmic information theory, constructive mathematics in Arup Bishop's sense, in theoretical physics, and equilibrium dynamics. Hi, Carl. Thanks a lot for coming onto the podcast.
Yes, hello. Thank you for inviting me.
So we're going to be talking about your book. It's called UFOs, Unidentified Aerial Phenomena, Observations, Explanations, and Speculations. But all your other books are about other subjects. You've got a book called Mathematical Methods of Theoretical Physics. You've got one called Quantum Logic, another book, Physical Causality. So why is it now you've decided to write a book about UFOs?
Because I believe the topic is of potential importance, of very high potential importance. It may well be a nothing burger, but if there is something to it, it's of so high importance that, in my opinion, it deserves to be investigated by scientists. And many scientists don't do it. I have done this because I think, you know, I'm really dedicated, as almost every scientist, they are very emotional about their thrive to know the truth, you know, and well, I seem to be particularly interested in some hidden truths that may open up totally new vistas on worldviews and what's going on at the moment. I don't think that too many people in too many colleagues might be interested. But, you know, my real advantage is that I know the two worlds, and I try to apply the methods that I used to apply in science proper. I apply to this phenomena. But of course, I'm not alone with this. There have been many before, and there will be many after me. So I'm just an intermediary. Yeah.
And do you feel that a lot of this stuff to do with UFOs, it's just fleeting, isn't it? It comes and goes really quickly. And so to apply science to investigate it can be very difficult.
Yeah, in a sense, it's a little bit because you cannot stimulate experiments. I mean, the Russians have reportedly done this, but you cannot summon a UFO in general, you know. So you are absolutely correct. So repeatability, which is a big issue in science, unfortunately, is not the case. I mean, science, empirical science, is very much into repeatability, and every time you switch off, you switch on the light in your room, you test the Maxwell equations. You know, and you verify, or you don't falsify, let's say, according to Popper, you don't falsify the Maxwell equations. And this, as you said, this cannot be done with UFOs because they are transient phenomena. But you have also to figure out that, I mean, many phenomena in, for instance, astronomy have previously or are still transient. And there are phenomena like ball lightning and so on, which may be transient as well. So this is not the only case. Also, one has to really, this is very important for me, one has to really acknowledge that one has to imagine what these phenomena are and from their side, you know, not from our side. We tend to anthropomorphically project into these phenomena what we want them to be, you know, and not what their interests are. So basically you have to put them yourself in their shoes and ask yourself what would you do. But it's clear, as you said, from a methodological point of view, there's this difficulty that you cannot summon and reproduce these phenomena. That's correct. Yes.
Some of the phenomena seems to be perhaps ethereal or multidimensional. I've heard people report seeing craft, not just a light in the sky, but daytime, and saying that it just looked weird. It's like it was partly here and partly not here, which makes examining it even more difficult if it seems to be popping in and out of reality.
Right, which makes the phenomenon even more important and interesting from a physics point of view. You know, but of course, you know, the problem is like this. If it's quite ordinary and we can research it and figure it out right away, it might be accessible to us easier. But the more etheric it gets, the more we could in principle learn, but the more we can't actually investigate it. So there's a dichotomy, I would say. But we have to live with it, you know. Life is just like life is. There is Sigmund Freud said you have just to take the situation or the patient or the client as it is. You know, you should not interpret too much of it. And if it's etherically, well, it may appear etherical. Some electromagnetic phenomena appeared very etherical when we first observed them, you know. And I think it's not a coincidence that if you read Conan Doyle, you know, I very much like to read Conan Doyle, and not only Sherlock Holmes. Conan Doyle turns out to be a spiritist, but you know, there was this big era of spiritism in Fin de Siècle, around 1900. And even theoretical physicists like Hans Thiering, who was an Academy of Science member, of Austrian Academy of Science member, a little bit later, they made experiments with seances and so on and so forth. And try to figure out if these are hoaxes and so on. At that time, you know, everything seemed possible. Which, for instance, Hertz, I think it was Hertz, spent long hours in dark rooms figuring out how the electromagnetic field can be detected by spark discharges from inductions, you know. So suddenly there would be some spark discharges and so on, out of nowhere, you know, from the, well, what they might have called beyond, you know, or whatever, or ether or so. And now we call it electromagnetic field, you know. For us, the notion of electromagnetic field is not esoteric at all. But for them, there must have been this element of surprise. And they thought there was much more in there when they did seances and so on and so forth. And This is not what one has to think of it in historic terms. You know, this is not totally unusual. Not totally unusual also for physicists. The electromagnetic phenomena were very obscure at some point. There is a great BBC documentary about the discovery of electromagnetism. I highly recommend everybody to read it, to look at it. I think it's in public domain at the moment. So it may be that in some future times this won't be esoteric at all for us, or etheric or extraordinary, if we are used to the phenomena. But nowadays we are not yet, or not, and probably they don't exist. The problem is, you know, as I said before, it may well be that they might not exist, but if they exist, this is fundamental. You know, this changes everything. So it's well worth investigating seriously. But in doing that, one has to acknowledge that the powers that be might have some other intentions with these phenomena. And this is totally understandable.
And it seems that there's a modern age of UFOs that started after the Second World War, which some people have attributed to the use of the atom bomb, that grabbed the attention of the UFOs.
Right. The ignition of the first, it's like a watershed. Before our discovery of the nuclear fire, it's like Prometheus, you know. We discovered this fire by ourselves, I believe. Even before that, there have been sightings, above Hanford, that is hardly recorded. That was earlier than the ignition, earlier than Alamogordon. So even before that, there were alleged sightings above some nuclear sites, because the Americans had certain plants in which they enriched plutonium and uranium, and one was Hanford, for instance, and there was a sighting in Hanford even before the ignition of the first nuclear device. But afterwards there was a flurry of UFO sightings that culminated in these Washington flyovers in July 1952. Yeah, it's as if they intended to land at the lawn of the White House.
And with the atomic bomb and nuclear weapons, you talk in the book about UFOs that seem to interfere with the nuclear missiles, and that this happens in Russia just as much as anywhere else.
Correct. But of course, in Russia, this was behind the Iron Curtain. And not much was known about this. And afterwards, the problem with Russian sources is that you cannot really verify very well their trustworthiness. But in America, there have been, for instance, a book by Hastings. I think it's called UFOs and Nukes, and many other people who came forward. There was an entire series of stations of Minuteman rockets, these intercontinental ballistic missile sites, and there was also many incidences in many such bases, not only one. After they were erected, UFOs were seen, and it's like somebody some UFO inhabitants made a pastime in or enjoyed setting some of those in, making some of those in operational. This happened in some bases. For instance, one in one basis, they shut down 10 Minutemen rock intercontinental ballistic missiles, and there was a successive IBM investigation, because I believe IBM was in charge of this, as far as I remember. And the IBM technicians couldn't find any reason for that. So it it was very, very curious. You know, I think they were just, if they exist, they were just playing with this. You know, well, one should, you know, you have to look at this phenomena also from the visitor's side. You know, if there is a planet who is on the verge of nuclear fire, you just look at the planet. You try to figure out what they are up to and if they pose some threat in the future and when that will be, and you play around with their military installations. You know, it's a little bit like us in this with the Sentinelese or some other tribes that that the Europeans discovered, which were not so advanced technologically as the Europeans were.
And it's this thing where the UFOs, these ETs, if they are real, and they might pay attention to us because we've started exploding nuclear weapons. But the thing is, space is so big. How would they even know that we're doing it? That's one thing that I wonder about, is if they're so far away, how could they even tell? And also, we may be one planet out of so many billions of planets. Why would they really care that this one gets affected?
But this is a very interesting statement you made, because there are so many assumptions in this statement. Let's just analyze your statement, yeah?
Okay.
Or the assumptions implicit in your statement. The first assumption is that space is it's so far away, you know, so far away with respect to what, you know. For instance, I have booked a flight to New Zealand. I will, God permitting, Deo volente, I will go to Auckland in. Starting from this Sunday, yeah. In the coming Sunday, I will book an airliner, and it will take me approximately a day to go there, 24 hours. That's probably the fastest time you can go from Vienna to Auckland. And if you think of that in terms of previous technologies, this is. The distances seem to shrink. You know, it depends on the technology, and there may be let's say, if I would be able to go by a hypersonic aircraft, it would be faster. It would be probably only half a day or so. You know, and half a day, or it would be even much faster if I would go via higher up and go into space and then back very fast. And this might be a hop, you know, hop on, hop off, you know. So interstellar distances, you should not think that all we know now, the limits that we are confronted with now, these limits will be there forever. In particular, and this is one of my interests in this, in particular, interstellar space travel might be not that tedious, not that rough as we might think if new technologies show up, you know. And I'm not only, you know, people are always talking, well, what how long will a space travel take? Yeah, how long will it take relative to the means that we have now? Yeah, but you should really be considering what other means are possible. Maybe there are means that allow faster than light travel, and then it might be hop on, hop off again, you know. So this is, I think, an ahistoric thinking if one believes that space, that planets are far away. Secondly, I totally agree. We are unimportant. Yes, we are unimportant, but also unimportant planets have to be attended to. You know, you just to make sure that at some point you are not surprised by things that you don't want to happen to you. You know, so they may be just monitoring us, and they may have been monitoring us for a long time. You know, there are reports from antiquity and even before, before we developed some kind of valid recordable scripture that some kind of fables and fairy tales and so on and so forth, they may point to the direction that there have been visitations before. But you know, if we would be developing a hyper civilization spreading over many planets, over many suns, we would just register all of them, keep them in some sort of database, and just look at their status. And you probably don't have to look so closely if you are technologically, you haven't developed electromagnetism, you know, but you might start monitoring a civilization closer when they are on the verge of developing, in particular, an interstellar space travel device. And this is the scenario, by the way, that I think one Star Trek movie has, you know. So because when they first had this hyperdrive, there was a craft from Romulus, or how is this? Oh, from Vulcan, from Vulcan, who was visiting them. So, yeah, you know, I think they are very concerned that we can go to them.
And there are people who have come forward, like whistleblowers, like Bob Lazar, who says that we have the craft, and he said that he was tasked with working out the propulsion system, and he described it in detail. Talked to a guy the other day, a guest on this podcast, and he was saying some other physicist examined what Bob Lazar said, and this other physicist was saying, you know what, this probably works, this propulsion system for traveling beyond the speed of light. Have you examined any of these?
First of all, I don't want to say anything about Bob Lazar.
Oh, okay.
Well, Bob Lazar is a figure that I don't even want to touch on. I don't disqualify him, but let me not discuss because I have no opinion on him. You know, I find him some entertaining, you know, and he may be right, but this is too vague for me, you know. With respect to the physics he described, this appears to be weird to me. I'm not really in the position of either checking that or, I mean, for instance, this element, I think 115 or so. I mean, of course, there exists such an element, but this is very unstable and decays immediately. Now you can say, well, with another isotope, everything becomes more stable, but there's no indication for that. But you know, I would not exclude anything, But I would so in my book I haven't mentioned Lazar, but I would say there are three criteria that make me rather more convinced now than previously that there is something to our collecting non-human craft. And the first is the first criteria or the first indication is this so-called Wilson memo. I'm sure you know of that, and I'm quite sure that many of your listeners know of the Wilson memo. And the Wilson memo, the central sentence of the Wilson memo says that the Americans are in possession of a craft that is not of this earth. This has been authenticated. So the authentication of the Wilson memo has been authenticated. It was probably a Christmas gift by Chris Mellon in a blog entry last year. So this was Christmas 2022, where Chris Mellon says that it's authentic. So this is the first indication. The second is Grush, who I think David Grush, who recently came up and talked about hearsay, but reliable hearsay, according to him, that we are in possession of craft not of this earth. So this is consistent with the Wilson memo, and there is a third one, which just a book that recently came out by Lakatsky and Kelleher. And I think also by Knapp. So these were these three authors. And the most important sentence in this regard for me was the sentence that Lakatsky said that he knows, probably by hearsay, but probably he has even seen that. There exists a YouTube where you can watch him making some gestures when the host asked him whether he has experienced it by himself, not only hearsay. So, but the central sentence is that the U.S. has one craft, and has accessed it and has entered it, was able to penetrate the surface of the craft. So these are and these are people, you know, let's say Chris Mellon and Lakatsky and Grush, I would not distrust. So these are highly trust for me, at least. You know, there is always the question. This is an interesting question, also in general. You know, what is truth? You know, what is truth? You know, and there have been very recently with events, medical events recently, heavy much debated. You know, what is truth? You know, I believe if you look deep into the issue, there isn't any good answer to that question other than very personal answers. So if you are convinced, if you believe that you are convinced, that's true for you, you know, and for me, for all practical purposes, this is a saying by the physicist John Bell, for all practical purposes, it's quite clear that the Americans are in the possession of the craft. But for all practical purposes, it's totally indifferent because I won't be shown this craft because I am an alien subject. I mean, I'm a human, but I'm not even a citizen of the United States, and they won't show it, of course. And I understand that, of course. So for all practical purposes, it's of no consequence for me. But at least I find it gratifying that I can now say that to very high, or for me, to a higher probability than not, the United States is in possession of at least one craft that is not of this earth and has non-human origins.
And one of the questions is that you asked this in the book, if they've got this craft and they may have been crashed craft.
Or gifted.
Oh yeah, because the thing is, why or how would a UFO crash if their technology is so good? Did they crash on purpose?
Yeah, first question that comes to mind. Yeah, first question. Yeah, of course, I had this question as well. And by the way, Grush was asked in this recent hearing in Congress exactly the same question. It's a very obvious question, you know. Why are there no good photos? And why are there? And they asked him why have these guys, I mean, they were coming from some other place far away. Why should they crash in a thunderstorm, let's say, in Roswell, you know? And he gave, I think, an answer, David Grush, that was also given much earlier, in a much earlier book. I forgot. I have to recover that. But but this book is an interesting book because the author, I believe, only wrote one book about the subject, a very pessimistic book about the subject. And he also said, well, you know, for instance, if I fly to Auckland now, I hope that the airplane wouldn't crash, you know. But sometimes some airplanes crash, you know. The probability is very low, but sometimes these things happen, you know. We don't know the. Well, one of the big issues is this has been put asked by Dolan, Richard Dolan, often. You know, do we really know the frequency of this craft moving around? So is it on the average? Is it one craft per minute or so, you know, or are there 10 crafts in the atmosphere at the moment or whatever, you know? And Brams, I think it's called Bramsley. I have to look. And he made a calculation and I repeated that calculation. And it's quite reasonable. So that with reasonable side assumptions, very conservative assumptions, one craft crashes at least every 500 years, you know.
Yeah.
If there's a probability of crash of one to 1 million or so, the craft moves in the atmosphere per day or so, I don't remember the calculation, but it was quite reasonable. And I just redid the calculation. I think it's in Bramsley, but Grush said the same thing, but he didn't do the calculation. Of course, it was too short time, and this is an obvious answer. I believe that things go wrong sometimes, you know, with all technologies.
Well, can we move on a little bit and talk about abductions? Because you talk about this in the book. What do you feel is happening there? Do you think it's people are making it up or they're delusional?
Yeah, well, let me say this. I was at one point, I have no abduction experience. I'm no experience. I've never seen a UFO. But I, at some point, I did a psychoanalysis myself and I was attached somehow to the Viennese Psychoanalytic Society, or societies, actually. Actually, I brought Anton Seilinger to some of those meetings, who now own the Nobel Prize. And these meetings took place in the old, very nice flat in the Viennese 19th district. And I always thought, well, you know, if I do this and that, Freud must have seen the same scenery around and so on and so forth. And if you look at it from a psychoanalytic point or from a psychological point of view, these issues need at least attention because these people are suffering, you know. And as these people are deeply, you know, they, Mack had this expression of ontological shock. You know, this is, they had a deep, how should I say, a deep experience, a deep, how you call it, a deep distress or a deep PTSD. Yes, yes. They had post-traumatic stress disorder. So at least this has these events for some people, if regardless of their ontological status, regardless of if they really happened or not, you know, these people should be taken more, taken more care of. They should be not laughed at, and they should be treated in a way with respect, you know. And maybe it turns out that some of them have other maladies, you know, are maybe psychotic or schizophrenic, but maybe there are some hardcore cases which cannot be just disregarded. There is one issue, but we are now going into some deeper things. Which may not be interesting to many listeners, but you know, for instance, the problem with psychoanalysis, Freud started with hypnosis, you know, and many other people. There were many other people doing hypnosis as therapy, but Freud then abandoned this idea of going to the subconsciousness with hypnosis. But most of those stories of experiences are emanated from hypnotic experiences and from experiences, that were done with hypnotists that were sometimes not very versed in their art. Or in their science or whatever, or in this method, you know. And Freud, I believe one of the reasons Freud disengaged with hypnosis was that it was not, that it was too insecure. It was very difficult to figure out what was really going on. And maybe there were some suggestions, they could have some expectations, some projections, and so on and so forth. So for Freud, for some reason, I'm still not very well aware of which reasons, but I believe because of the precision of what actually happened. Freud abandoned hypnosis and rather adopted the psychoanalytic techniques. So talking, dreaming, and so on. But of course, also these techniques are not reliable and take a long time and so on and so forth. So but hypnosis, I believe the way Mack, now I'm saying some heresies here for the community, but
that's, Professor Mack, isn't it, from Harvard?
Yeah. Mack was, I think he self-taught himself hypnosis and then practiced it. This may be fine, but from a psychoanalytic standpoint, I wouldn't agree with that too much. But if applied correctly, maybe it yields... It yields a very deep understanding of the subject, but we have to find out. And in any case, you know, even if it's there is trauma involved, and we have to help these people. We cannot just laugh at them. And this is actually what happens, you know. These people are abandoned, basically, you know, abandoned by our system.
If they're getting hypnosis to try and recover memories of something that happened, they must have memories that have nothing to do with hypnosis. Otherwise, how would they know they need to try the hypnosis?
Well, obviously, they can fantasize. You know, I give you another. After my PhD studies, I went to Berkeley, and in Berkeley, I was confronted with some guy who showed up in the Berkeley philosophy or psychology department, talking about Freud's sins, you know. And the problem was that many women who were Freud's clients, mostly from Jewish community in Vienna, they were saying that they were abducted by their fathers or by the uncle, you know, or some high-ranking member of this community, you know. And Freud at some point believed that this is correct. So he gave a lecture in Vienna and said, there are many abductions taking place in Vienna by men against the woman of this community, young woman of this community. And he was totally, they froze him out of the community, you know. And the allegation is put forward by this person, and I never heard this in Vienna, you know, but maybe I'm just ignorant, but he became quite prominent, I believe, in his claims. Then Freud, because of this pressure, he came to the conclusion that maybe they have fantasized, you know. So it was not the guilt of the fathers and the uncles, but it was kind of the fantasies of these women, you know. And this is, of course, the worst that could have happened, you know. It's not clear what really happened, you know. And one should give Freud the benefit of the doubt. But this is typically, you know, a typical situation where you don't know what really happens, you know. If after some time your daughter says you have abducted her, you know, probably you know it, or you suppressed it by yourself in some sense, you know, what happened, you know, what happened is very difficult. Is again a question, and if fantasies are involved, you can get anything, but on the other hand, you have to take these people seriously. And the question is, how can you do that? And actually, I don't have a criterion for this. I believe this claim against Freud is unresolved to this date. It depends on who you ask. You know, if you ask somebody from the conformist Freud community, he will say these are rubbish. And if you ask some more open-minded people, they would say, well, probably there was something to that. You know. And the same issue is with abductions. But one thing, you know, is very clear. These people are suffering a lot, suffer from trauma, and they have to be helped in some way, you know. So this is my call, in honor of these people, to try from the psychology community to try to cope with these issues. The psychology community is a funny community, because everything they cannot cure, and they cannot cure a lot. They can cure very little. They almost abandon, you know, they push it under the rug. But this is too serious, you know, and the suffering of these people, and I have learned to know some experiences. They suffer a lot, and this is not good, and they should be taken should be taken more seriously in their suffering, at least.
What do you make of the Travis Walton incident? Because there were multiple witnesses there when the actual abduction took place, although I think he says now he doesn't think it was abduction as so much as they tried to help him.
The aliens tried to help him? I have never heard that. Yeah, I mean, the Walton case is a case of many aspects. I don't know. I cannot say anything about it. I know a lot of it, but I would say the Hill case is probably the first case, the first Benny and Barney Hill. This is also an issue. So you see, I think one should really acknowledge that one doesn't know. There are so many people who try to be pushy and say, well, I know, and we should be doing this. I have more a Socratic perspective. I think, you know, and this is also Freudian. I learned this from Freud. Freud said, you have to accept everything that comes up, but you have to be aware that and also from Karl Popper, you have to be aware that you know not many things. So you have to be open to everything. You shouldn't believe in any of these things, but you should also not rule out something at first, you know. And you know, this issue is also complicated because there are a lot of actors that have their own how should I say, their own goals, you know. May I quote? Because I very much like the chapter 10 of a book, of an autobiography he was an extra equerry to Her Royal Highness Prince Elizabeth and His Royal Highness the Duke of Edinburgh. This person is called Peter Horsley, and he wrote a very interesting book, in particular chapter 10, called The Visitors. This is the title of he was probably due to the interest of the Duke himself, but also his own interest. He writes that he went to Prince Philip at first, and Prince Philip says, well, if you don't stir too much questions, stir up too many people, you can pursue that. But I believe Prince Philip has had a genuine interest in that. And I think David Clark, he is a critical researcher of UFOs in Great Britain. He calls Prince Philip the Royal Sorcerer. that's very, very nice and a little bit funny also. He says that there are some types of people surrounded or attached to UFOs. He says they're objective observers with no self-interest. So, for instance, if you're an officer of the Royal Air Force, you know, of the United States Air Force, you are not really interested in talking too much about UFOs because that might not foster your career. That's a typical issue, you know. But then Horsley says there's also a growing body of people. I'm quoting as of chapter 10 now. A growing body of people promoting sightings for mercenary reasons or self-advertisement, you know. This is very evident if you see the community now as it presents itself. And then there are observers suffering from flying saucer psychosis or mental illness. And finally, practical jokers, he says. Yeah. So you have to, how you call it? A Spreu vom Weizen, we call it in German. So you have to sort out the chaff from the wheat. You call it chaff from the wheat.
Yeah.
And the chaff, you know, the chaff is everywhere, you know. So if you have, for instance, the sightings that were looked at in in the Condon report turned out to be more than 99% of natural origin, or of origins that can be explained by non-alien origin. But of course, the question is, just because we can explain 99% and we have sorted out this hardcore, probably 0.5%, should we disregard the 0.5%? This is a question that was posed by the American Association for Aerospace Engineers. But if you read this chapter here, this chapter has as a central piece of it, it has some sightings, you know, some sightings that have been experienced by some objective observers with no self-interest. So they were officers of the Royal Air Force, and they were not self-promoting themselves. They hesitantly gave answers to Horsley when he asked, and it's quite clear that they have no, how should I say, money intentions to monetize on their experiences. You know, this is or in any way they just said something because they were asked to by a very competent person who asked them. So, but the central part I highly recommend is Janus. It's called Janus. Janus is a subsection of this
in the book,
of this chapter in the book, and this Janus describes quite consistently how these others might see us and why they wouldn't want us to acknowledge them or to come forward, to stay in the background, you know.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons is that basically we cannot give them anything, you know, there is little they can gain, or almost nothing. Of course, we can gain a lot if they disclose themselves. And let's say if there is a alien Prometheus, you know, this is a classical Greek legend. Prometheus gave fire to the humans. So if they gave us their drives, we could go to them. And we see in Europe and America and everywhere now, Australia, New Zealand, to what that leads, you know? The issue is that you have to also see that they want to just look what's happening, look at the status, but they probably are totally disinterested in getting in any way in contact with us. Just on the opposite. They don't want to communicate, and yeah, they don't want the ocean.
Well, it's been great talking to you. We've been talking about your book, which is called UFOs, Unidentified Aerial Phenomena, Observations, Explanations, and Speculations. And people can get that on Amazon, can't they?
Yes. Yes, of course.
And it's been great talking to you. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
And thanks for having me.
And that was an interview with Carl Svozil about his book, UFOs, Unidentified Aerial Phenomena, Observations, Explanations, and Speculations. And a great way to support the podcast is to sign up to Patreon, where you can hear the extended episode, which is an extra 22 minutes. Just go to patreon.com/alienUFOpodcast. If you join the $2 a month tier, you get an extended episode every month. If you join the $5 a month tier, you'll have access to an extended episode every week. And when you sign up, you get access to the episodes in the back catalogue, and they are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. And please check out my other podcast. It's called Past Lives Podcast, and there are over 280 episodes. On Past Lives podcast, I look into evidence of an afterlife, such as near-death experiences, children with past life memories, mediumship, deathbed visions, and other phenomena. I also release an extra episode of Past Lives podcast every Thursday that's called Paranormal Stories. My website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk, and the link is in the show notes. In my work as a clinical hypnotherapist, I take people through past life regression. And when you book a past life regression hypnosis session with me, and you've signed up to Patreon, you get a 25% discount. And I'm offering a free consultation call, which can be booked on my website. My Instagram is the Past Lives Podcast with an underscore between each word. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening. There may be so many talented people in the world who could really help with the project. Maybe they're trying to back engineer something, but because they cut everybody out, their progress is real slow. The talent doesn't get there.
Yeah, but you have to weigh that and compare that to the disadvantage if you put these things in open access, and probably they are not allowed to do that, you know.